Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to Lights, Camera, Crime, the dark side of the entertainment industry. A few weeks ago, local media began reporting on a story involving local social media influencers who had seemingly been duped into working on a campaign to promote a very dubious alleged employment opportunity for young South Africans in Russia. Many South Africans were shocked that this could happen. And as I read the articles and the responses from the seemingly surprised influencers, I couldn't help but feel that people who work in the entertainment and PR industries might not be as surprised as everyone else at this turn of events. And then I saw a blog post written by Rosie Motene, who I met when we both worked on the School Ties podcast. And that confirmed it for me. There are dark things happening in the entertainment and adjacent industries. And it's complex and something we all need to know about. You might be wondering how I'm connecting social media influencers with the entertainment industry, which in most people's minds consists of performing arts like acting, singing, dance, and the like. Well, I think that our methods of entertainment have changed and expanded now that social media is such a big part of many of our lives. Our sources of entertainment have changed to include digital creators, podcasts, YouTube channels, and, yes, influencers and the content they create. I mean, these days it's not uncommon if you ask a child what they want to be when they're older to hear, "I want to be an influencer." I've spoken quite a bit about human trafficking and general exploitation in the last few episodes. In the Stolen Girl Companion podcast, my conversation with Bianca van Asviergen from Missing Children South Africa even veered in this direction when she mentioned how she'd recently dealt with a case where a young woman was lured to Dubai for what she thought was a modeling opportunity. And when she got there, it turned out to be something very different and much darker. Thankfully, the young lady was able to escape the situation by getting in contact with the South African consulate in Dubai, who helped her to get back to South Africa. But as we learned in that episode, that is not what happens for most people in these situations. In fact, only 1% of trafficking victims will ever escape their situations and return home. And the other side of this is that trafficking and exploitation doesn't always mean you'll be held and never returned home. Sometimes the trafficking or exploitation situation is always intended to be temporary, but the emotional and sometimes physical scars you return home with will remain with you forever. On other occasions, victims under the influence of coercive control and being wholly convinced that their careers are on the line will return to exploitative and abusive situations multiple times over. So in this episode, we're going to explore several rabbit holes related to this topic. The first is this Russian work program that's been in the news and whether or not it's actually a form of human trafficking. And then we're going to talk to Rosie Motene, who in her 30 years in the entertainment industry has seen some stuff. And trust me, it's going to blow your mind. And you will for sure never see the industry the same way again. So first up is this Russian work program. It's called the Alabuga START program. The Alabuga reference comes from the name of the economic zone in Tatarstan in Russia, where recruits are sent to work. In May this year, after a lot of complaints about what was happening in Alabuga, the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime put together a report on what was happening there. And that has been the source of a lot of the information I'll be sharing here today. as it's a neutral organization and their research is fair and unbiased as far as I guess is possible. I think that's important because I went into this realizing that with there being a war going on between Russia and Ukraine, it is very possible that some sources may be pro either side, and therefore I'd have to approach any information out there with caution. But I do think that this report is probably the most neutral source I'll find. 2 years before the Alabuga story hits our own headlines here in South Africa, the Russian media, as well as media from other Western countries, began talking about the exploitative aspects of a recruitment program being run within the Specialized Economic Zone, or SEZ. Mostly because of the war with Ukraine, Russia was experiencing a labor shortage, and they started staffing their drone production facility in Alabuga with students from a training college based at the site. These were mainly Russian students studying there at the time, but those students would start to report that they started seeing large groups of migrant workers arriving at the site and starting to work in the facility. In case you're wondering why a country would need an entire drone production facility, it's also because of the war. The drones are used in attacks on Ukraine. They don't carry weapons or bombs. They are the bombs, essentially. They're basically kamikaze drones that dive bomb into targets. The specific program targeting foreigners to work at Alabuga is called Alabuga Start. Now, for me, the first red flag comes in with the recruitment drive's very specific target demographic. Alabuga Start specifically targets young women, aged 18 to 22, and primarily from Africa, but also Latin America, South Asia, and some former Soviet countries. The reason they've given for only targeting this demographic is that women are less likely to be combative and argumentative when working in close quarters, and more likely to be agreeable to the program's rules and regulations. Now, that is a little concerning because, firstly, you're hugely generalizing. But also, it's sort of saying that you know there's going to be some major pushback at some point, and women would be, I don't know, easier to control, less likely to create issues and stand up for themselves. Either way, it's a weird way to explain your focus. Because why do you need consenting people to also be incredibly agreeable if they're already getting what they expected to get? Strange. The other side of this is that they are clearly targeting countries with large populations of unemployed or economically vulnerable people. And many of the reports coming out of Russia itself say that this is because locals would not work for the remuneration being offered. A source in Russia said, quote, "Russians are simply not ready to work for 30,000 to 40,000 rubles, an estimated 300 to 400 US dollars. In third world countries, the starting salary is very low, about $200, and that's why foreigners from exotic countries are ready to work for such money," end quote. For context, 30,000 rubles is about 6,200 rand. The most recent Alabuga Start adverts, along with interviews with recruiters and participants, state the starting salary for a participant is actually around $500 per month. But many participants have reported that when they get to Russia, they're finding that this is not the case, and they're being paid less, or there are deductions being made from their salaries, which were not discussed beforehand. These two aspects are common flags in human trafficking and extortion situations. And you may wonder why someone from South Africa would go all the way to Russia, while that country is at war, to earn what is essentially just 2,000 rand over minimum wage in our country. Well, I think it's because the program is packaged as much more than just a job. Many participants, and certainly those being targeted by influencers, are being promised a start in life where they'll not only be paid the salary, but also get to learn about another culture, be taught Russian, and many are promised free tuition in the Alabuga College on site. Most are under the impression that their food and accommodation will also be taken care of, and when they leave Russia, they'll have a set of sought-after skills that they can then translate into an easy transition into employment when they get back home. So when you look at it like that, it actually seems like something a young South African woman, fresh out of school and perhaps living in an economically vulnerable situation with few prospects for employment, could see as a pretty good deal. Unfortunately, many participants have publicly admitted that what they're getting is not what they were promised. Many have done nothing but manufacture drones from the moment they arrived at the site. They haven't seen the inside of the college, and some even admit that they have had accommodation and food deductions made from their salaries, leaving them with almost nothing at the end of the month. The contract period for the program is 2 years, and those who've completed their 2 years have confirmed that they were able to leave with no issue. I will also say that not all people who've participated or are currently in the program view the situation as exploitative, and there haven't been any public reports of anyone being forced to stay if they wanted to go home. A website called Alabuga Truth makes far darker claims about participants' experiences, saying that drug gangs hound those living on the site, and some women have claimed that they were fired but not helped to leave Russia, and as such have been forced to work in the sex trade to feed and house themselves. There have also been claims of racist attacks and serious hate crimes against the mainly African participants in the program. The website has a tab labelled Useful Idiots, which has the photographs and names of influencers across the world who've been hired by Alabuga to promote the program. Some South Africans do appear on there. The influencers are often flown out to Russia and given a tour of some parts of the site. But the South African influencers who went did admit that they felt the tour was heavily curated, and all of the footage they took was quite far from where the actual participants were working. They also didn't get an opportunity to interact with any of the participants while they were there. Now, in fairness, this is a key site of weapons of war manufacturing, so you can probably understand why they wouldn't want too much filming going on there. But also, how many of these participants know that they are actually going to Russia primarily, and in most cases solely, to support their war effort? And are they aware of the danger involved? In June this year, the Alabuga site was targeted by Ukrainian forces with their own drones. Thankfully, none of the participants were killed, but some were injured, and the building sustained heavy damage. The government departments involved in issuing passports and visas in the various target countries across the world have started looking closer at those applying for travel to Russia, and some are issuing warnings to those young women who appear to be leaving for Alabuga. With so much of the advertising happening on largely unregulated platforms, though, like social media, where even if you report a video, if their AI bots don't find what they're specifically looking for, nothing will be done. It's difficult to know exactly how many people are being targeted for this program. And the program itself acknowledges that they almost solely use social media influencers to get the word out. Now, in today's day and age, that's not entirely abnormal. Lots of brands use influencers for advertising. But when an organization is advertising what is essentially a job opportunity for foreigners, They'll usually go through formal channels too, like job portals and government departments in various countries, who can vet the opportunity and promote it to their interested citizens. And Alabugastart does not do that. Well, in fairness, they have dealt directly with government officials in very select countries, but only after signing agreements with those officials similar to those signed by the influencers used to promote their program. As I alluded to earlier, I am well aware that there is, and probably always will be, a lot of negative bias toward much of what Russia does as a country. And we need to take that into account. Russian spies, Russian bots, Russian mind control programs. Anytime anything vaguely weird happens, Russia gets dragged into it, whether they're involved or not. But there is actual evidence here. And no one is claiming that these participants are disappearing in the night, never to be seen again. It's just that the conditions of this program are definitely suspect. And it's specifically targeting vulnerable people by its own admission. And as someone who's often approached by brands to advertise for them, I understand the value of making sure you align with the people or products you're promoting. And while all of those influencers involved have apologized and removed their affiliations with the program, I can't help but think that all it would have taken was a simple Google search to find the exact information I've just found. I understand these are super famous, busy influencers, but a lot of them have managers too. And if they aren't vetting the stuff themselves, then those employed to literally manage their reputation certainly should be, in my humble opinion. It's all fun and games in the spotlights, but there's also a responsibility there, I think. Hopefully others will think twice in the future. So what's the verdict? Is the Alabugastart program a human trafficking ring? Well, this is from the official report. Quote, "The UN Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime defines trafficking in persons as the act of recruiting or transporting someone using coercion or deception for the purpose of exploitation. Its legal definition is as follows. Trafficking in persons shall mean the recruitment, transportation, transfer, harboring, or receipt of persons by means of the threat or use of force or other forms of coercion, of abduction, of fraud, of deception, of the abuse of power, or of the position of vulnerability, or of the giving or receiving of payments or benefits to achieve the consent of a person having control over another person for the purpose of exploitation. Alabuga clearly engages in some level of deception about the nature of the work it offers its recruits, but other aspects of the roles it promotes to applicants are accurate and therefore not deceptive, including some of the types of manufacturing and other work involved and the Russian language courses offered. There are coercive elements, and the program exploits the vulnerability of young female migrant workers to ensure they carry out tasks that others, including the Russian workers at the site, are unwilling to do. In terms of the test of exploitation, the women are brought into these coercive working conditions to ensure profitability at the plant and maintain production for Russia's war effort. At the same time, some participants said they accepted the work conditions and pay offered by the program, and the feeling of exploitation was not universally shared. Furthermore, participants can leave at the end of their 2-year contract, a fact confirmed by former participants interviewed for this research. Whistleblowers from Alabuga and investigations in the media have brought much of this evidence to light. Based on the available evidence, it would not be accurate to describe this as a clear-cut case of human trafficking, but something that is more akin to fraudulent exploitation. The situation does not present a case for wholesale denial of the participants' rights, but it is, nonetheless, an exploitative working environment. This was reflected in the participants' divergent views of the work they were recruited to perform, which varied from feelings of exploitation to acceptance of the working conditions. End quote. If you ask other sources, like those behind the Alabuga Truth website, they may have a different view. Either way, proceed with caution. I think the point here is that the social media influencers who, let's face it, have a lot of sway with young people these days, could be used by very real human trafficking rings, ones much worse than Alabuga. And if that is possible, it's a terrifying thought, because it wouldn't be the first time, nor likely the last. So with that in mind, let's get into the second part of this episode, my conversation with Rosie Motene.
My name is Rosie Motene. I have been in the media space for close to 30 years, and 20 years of that within the activism space. I was trained through an organization called People Opposing Women Abuse, and have integrated all of my work into my three passions, which is women, Africa, and the arts. And for now, my focus is on my activism, my feminist writing, and integrating that into healing. So it's creating awareness of social justice issues that are close to my heart, particularly ones within the arts and the entertainment space. I have a company called Lidzatsi Healing Space, where I offer counseling and life coaching. And this came out of a traumatic event where I was blacklisted in the industry from being a TV actress for standing up against sexual harassment and refusing to perform nude scenes or sex scenes. And so that is me integrating my three passions, which are woman, Africa, and the arts.
I'm sure that after 30 years in the industry, Rosie must have seen a lot of changes and the scene having expanded to include new types of entertainment.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I had my talent agency a couple of years ago and I used to run castings, I saw a major shift within 5 years where, and it was rather frustrating because producers would say, okay, this person's great, but what is their following on social media? And I often had many fights because my argument was that, well, the person can't act. So why don't we rather get in an actress and then build up their social media, you know, in terms of when it comes to casting and being able to tell storytelling. So even that, the social media has marred the opportunities for talent to have some, you know, studied years and years becoming fantastic actors, but because they haven't got a strong presence in social media, they've often been let down by certain roles or not being cast in certain roles.
I mentioned at the top of this episode that Rosie had published a blog post that caught my eye. It's called Dreams for Sale: The Dark Link Between the Entertainment Industry and Trafficking. I'll link that post in the show notes, and I really recommend you go and read it. But it got me thinking about how Rosie might have experienced the entertainment industry, particularly as a woman, and some of the darker aspects of the industry she alludes to in her blog article.
Oh, wow. How much time do you have? Well, first of all, you know, sexism is everywhere. The patriarchy is pushed through, not just in the entertainment industry. But, you know, tackling particularly, and I'll start with Africa, tackling Africa as a queer female entrepreneur came with many, many challenges. First of all, you've got to constantly prove yourself. And that is where I had the advantage, because when I went in, I already had created my brand through Generations, which is doing incredibly well across the continent. So I already had that, almost that star power. And then when I did Studio 53, I had the backing of Mnet. So I was fortunate in that, but it didn't stop the sexism when it came to negotiating contracts. So I started a Pan-African talent agency. And when it came to negotiating certain contracts with producers, either local or all across the continent, I found it, I mean, in the beginning, I used to find it really frustrating, but then I just laughed it off at the fact that they thought that I didn't interrogate contracts, I didn't ask questions, and I didn't pick up the changes that they would make. So, for instance, in one example, one of my artists was cast for a well-known soapie that went into West Africa. And that contract was actually drawn up by MultiChoice South Africa. So no production company could change that. Mm-hmm. And I knew this because I'd obviously worked for MultiChoice for so many years. Mm-hmm. And so when it came to renewing his contract, which came from a West African country, I saw that they changed a particular clause, which basically stated that taking away his per diem rights, taking away, lessening his salary, all of these different things. And then I highlighted it. And then they got angry with me, like, how dare me as a woman speak up to a man of that stature and question? Fortunately, because it was MultiChoice, I had the backing and we were able to sort it out. So those were one of the issues that I noticed. But this is still even happening. What's scary, because the industry isn't regulated properly across the continent. I noticed there's a rise of just fly-by-night production houses, fly-by-night managers, casting agents who don't know the industry, but also it's opened up a gateway for sex traffickers. It's opened up a gateway for child abuse. And what I've noticed, particularly when I had the talent agency, is that people would then say, well, we've got this project, we want this and this and this and this. But then when I'd ask certain questions, I could feel that I was ruffling feathers and suddenly they would just disappear. Hmm. And so understanding that East Africa, I mean, and I speak about East Africa because I lived there and I'm sure it's the same on West Africa. But when I was living in Uganda, there was a huge influx of young girls just disappearing, offering because of jobs that had been offered overseas, entertainment contracts, so-called entertainment contracts had been offered overseas and in South Africa. And finding out that actually these girls just disappeared because they'd gone into sex trafficking rings. And so because I suppose I was a woman and I was a Black woman, and we must also understand that the sex trafficking rings are dominated predominantly within the West, I think a lot of people underestimated me questioning certain things or finding certain things in a red flag. And so we would get a lot of requests saying, well, we're going to offer this and this and this and this. And I would like, okay, but let's just break it down realistically. What do all of these terms actually mean? And what do they transcend into reality? And one came up just before I closed the agency, beginning of last year. And the wording in itself, I was like, okay, something is a bit amiss here. Because they kept on saying, we want to find Indigenous African people and take them to an exotic location and film them getting a first time on a plane, arriving at the exotic location, but we can't declare where this location was. So I said to the person, I said, we can assist you with sourcing these people, but we would need all of these details and we're willing to sign an NDA in this aspect. I'm very, very suspect of NDAs also, which we can talk about in a bit. But in this aspect, we would need to sign it because as an agent, I would need to know where these people are. But also if they're going to be getting passports and they're going to be getting visas, they need to know which destinations they're going to. After that question, then suddenly their emails changed. I couldn't get hold of them. Telephone numbers were blocked. So I was like, okay, I think we definitely averted a red flag or a danger zone on that level.
The Alabuga Starts situation, although perhaps not technically human trafficking, is still a really good example of how we have no idea what human trafficking actually looks like until people are in it. I asked Rosie what she had seen human trafficking look like in the entertainment industry.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at one of the cases where somebody shared their story with me about a young Kenyan girl who was taken over to India, offered specific jobs in India by somebody who grew up in her village. So this person had come back home and said, I'm doing very well. I'm a businesswoman. I'm looking for certain people to come over, went over, and then was thrown into a prostitution ring. So it's not about the Black van driving in the middle of the night and snatching you off the street. It's about finding credible spaces where they've now infiltrated. And so people on the ground think, okay, well, this is a trustworthy place, or they use specific logos. So for instance, a couple of years ago, there was a program called Gomorrah on Mzansi Magic. And somebody contacted me from Botswana who was on my books and said, look, this casting for Gomorrah is happening. Can I get in? And I looked at the page that it came from and it looked a bit suspect. And unfortunately, I knew the producers at the time. contact the producers. And I was like, what's going on? And they were like, no, we're not looking for casting. That's not our page. And fortunately, I was able to do that. But it's also using social media as another platform and saying, look, we can offer you this and this and this, using other brands, other programs, production houses, names as a way to get people into the door.
This is super common in other industries too. You'll often see these ads sharing jobs in government departments or the SAPS, and it looks like a labor broking organization. And then days later, you'll see one of those departments warning people that those ads are not real. Now, those could just be ordinary scams where they're going to fleece unsuspecting applicants out of money, but it could also very well be a human trafficking ring. Think about the barbershop episode I did, where those young girls thought that they were traveling to Johannesburg to learn how to be a hairdresser. And then they found themselves in a human trafficking situation where they were forced into sex work. This crime is incredibly pervasive. And unfortunately, we have to become super skeptical about everything to keep ourselves safe. I told Rosie about the young girl Bianca van Aswiechen had mentioned, who'd gone to Dubai for what she thought was a modelling opportunity. And then, of course, I've also covered Davy de Villiers, who may not have been physically trafficking young girls and women as such, but he was luring them through modelling contracts with the express intention of grooming and raping them.
Yeah. And that's also one of the reasons. So when I had my talent agency was that I specifically did not handle model contracts or music contracts, although I had people on my books who were models and musicians, purely because of within the TV and film industry, even beyond or outside of South Africa, there's always a connection that I can have and to double check. Whereas with the modeling industry, because it is so, I don't want to put such a negative word on it, but because these type of incidences and sexual harassment have been a lot more within that space. I'm not saying it's not happening within the TV industry, but you know, that's one of the reasons why I didn't want to handle those type of contracts, because I wasn't quite sure of the spaces that I would be sending my talent into. Mm-hmm. Within South Africa, you have the South African Guild of Actors who would supportive of me and during my case. And I know that if I'd sent somebody to a set and they had came up with the sexual harassment that I came up with, I could call SAGA or I would step on the set. Whereas within the model space, there's nobody a lot of the time on set that will stand up for a model who refuses to take off her clothing or refuses to be touched and so forth.
We'll get back to the Actors Guild and the work they're doing to help keep those in the entertainment industry safe. But I first wanted to get Rosie's reaction to this situation with the influencers promoting a pretty dubious situation. Because, as I said, I suspected that she was not entirely surprised at this.
And, you know, I saw a glimpse of another problematic podcast, but I watched it, where they were interviewing this guy who had recruited these influencers. And once again, I wasn't surprised because once again, fly-by-night managers coming in, wanting to make a quick buck, not doing due diligence, not finding out. And I'm not saying that he definitely knew about what was happening in Russia, but as a manager or as a company or a platform that's going to be bringing young girls or young people into a space, it is his responsibility to do their due diligence, to follow up, to check, to vet, and then take accountability, which is not doing at all. So I wasn't surprised at all, because also the influencer market, the rise of social media personalities, I think has been great. And we're not going to take that away. And I think it's phenomenal. And, you know, the likes of Bonang, the likes of these great Nigerian stars who have made it through the social media platform is something very, very inspirational. Mm. But it's also because we don't have the regulation and we don't have the means to support stardom and understand what stardom is. So people just want something that is just going to look good on the gram, but not really looking into what is it going to take to really get there, but also understand what social media is. So what, you know, with filters and what people are putting out there is not necessarily what is happening in people's lives. You know, and so when I've spoken to other people and other survivors of the life that they live as a social media person, so they'll go and hire a studio that looks at the inside of a jet, take pictures and saying they're flying around the world. That is fake. Or they're sitting in somebody, a billionaire's jet, taking those pictures, but then the price that they have to pay in order to go on that trip. And so we've seen it, and once again, I also averted even myself and certain clients from when this was happening in Dubai. And I think now Dubai authorities are already clamping down on that. Mm-hmm. But people say that, what do they call the potty parties that happen or used to happen in Dubai? I don't know if they still are happening. Mm-hmm. Came from through the social media and the influencer campaign. So going to be a little bit graphic in case your listeners don't know. So what happens at these potty parties is that models or influencers are invited through to by these wealthy billionaires and obviously have to service the men at the party, but also have to reenact and act certain horrific things, such as allowing to be defecated on. Before they go, they have to eat a certain amount of food so that their feces comes out in a certain way. So it's a whole lot of these things that are incredibly, incredibly degrading. Yeah. That have happened, but have happened because, I'm not saying because, but partly through the social media platforms where people say, well, look, yes, I'm in Dubai, I'm doing this, I'm flying to Nice, I'm doing that. But what are the costs of some of these people who have gotten to that point, who are taking those pictures? And I also need to iterate, not everybody's doing that. I'm not saying that every woman who gets on a flight and is going on a solo trip is serviced by another man. Absolutely not. But a lot of the time is that these lifestyle is then sold, but the price and the cost of getting that lifestyle is not transparent.
So what Rosie is referring to there is a phenomenon called potty parties or porta potty parties. And to anyone who lives on the more vanilla side of life with little to no exposure to the interesting trends out there, this is probably going to shock the socks off you. But essentially, what this is when young women are paid large sums of money, or sometimes not paid at all, but lured there simply by a so-called influencer trip. And they're brought to these parties where very wealthy individuals use these women to perform sex acts, which, if it's not your thing and you aren't prepared for it or expecting it, are incredibly degrading, including but not limited to defecating on others or being defecated on. This is not a new thing, and it's been happening in many different forms for a very long time, and not just in Dubai. In her blog, Rosie mentions the Jeffrey Epstein human trafficking ring not being a one-off, and there being many local examples of exactly those types of crimes. I asked her if she could expand on that for us.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's happening. Obviously it's wealthy individuals because they have the resources, but it's also not, you know, Jeffrey Epstein now has been painted as this dark person who he is. But if you looked at him in the beginning, he was associated and connected with incredibly powerful people. People thought he was good looking. People thought he was, you know, all positive. And that is the reality of these rings. That is the reality of the abuse, is that the people who are doing it are often the people that you grew up with, the person next door. It's not necessarily men. Yeah. We need to also take accountability that a lot of the people that the enablers are also women who've enabled this, who have recruited, who have groomed young women, young boys, young men into these various spaces. So it's not just out there, Hollywood, and beyond our reach. It's within our ranks. And while we're speaking, I'm just thinking of a tweet of a friend of mine who is a top executive at one of our top music brands. And when the Epstein case came out, he tweeted saying, yeah, this is horrific and whatever. And I responded back. I was like, but this is happening within our own ranks. In fact, we know it's even happening with certain people within your company. And I know you know about them. So why are you not tweeting about that? 5 minutes later, I was obviously blocked. But the reality is that it's happening within our shores. And we're so quick to look out. Yes, we need to acknowledge what's out there. But why are we not doing it in terms of holding people accountable on our own shores? And one of the things and I'm actually doing a presentation tomorrow on why the Me Too movement didn't get as much magnitude as the States. And yes, we have the total shutdown. We have other movements that have really done great work. But in terms of catching some of the biggest bigwigs in the entertainment industry, because they are so protected by men and women within the industry, and also we're dealing with the socioeconomic issues, with the post-apartheid issues, the proximity to power, not just men, but women, white women, black women across the board, that all plays its part. But everyone's saying, okay, well, let's look at Me Too. Let's look at Harvey Weinstein. And a lot of us are saying, but wait a minute, you're saying that, but you're having dinner with a very well-known predator. Yeah. You're sending your talent to, I mean, there's a well-known producer in our industry who has been producing a lot of TV shows, and how he recruits a lot of his young talent is he'll go into various villages and he refers to them as mattresses. And so his minions will go into these villages, recruit these people, bring them back to a really crummy house in Berea, sleep with them on the prospect that they're going to be cast in one of his top programs. And then they put in as an extra and then sent home again. And this has been, you know, and we've been trying to corner certain people in, and obviously curbed down a lot of the people that have come in and saved a few lives. But the reality is that he's still awarded new shows. He's still commissioned new shows. He's still revered in the industry. People know what he's doing, but they'd rather condemn Harvey Weinstein and the Americas, but won't look at what's happening within Mzansi.
There are so many layers to this. And I think that Rosie's reference to these young girls living in rural villages, for instance, really shows that these are some of the most vulnerable people, because they might not have access to a podcast like this, for instance, where they can learn about the red flags to look out for.
And so for them, the podcast would be like a misogynistic podcast where they're listening to how women are supposed to be treated. Yeah. And if you do speak up, this is what's going to happen. Yeah. You know, a couple of years ago when I was cyberbullied, and funny enough, not funny, but the reality is that I still get cyberbullied because of one particular podcast. Mm-hmm. And the messages I get from young girls are, well, some are like, really, really, you're very brave for continue speaking. Others are, well, now you understand why we don't speak up. Now you understand why we will never push certain cases because of what happens to people like you when you do speak up and you're condemned. And then you get the other flip side is that, well, it serves you right. Why are you speaking up? This is a man's world. Why are you going up against that? You know, so you get all of these different, and if, particularly if you've come from an environment where you don't have access to podcasts such as yourself, have access to proper advocacy and then resources. So if anything should happen, you can go and open up a case. Working with some of the grassroots organizations, different organizations have empowered communities. And so they've taken control of those communities and held people accountable, because they know that even if a person is empowered and wants to go open up a case, the police will dismiss it because of the levels of corruption. Mm. You know, so it's a vicious circle that we're living in because of the reality of the socioeconomic issues and structures that have been put up in our country.
And that made me think about the murder of Nokopila Khumalo, which I covered on the podcast, and her convicted murderer, Zweletu Mthethwa, who was a very well-known artist. And after his conviction, a few people came forward and said, well, he was accused many times of sexually harassing or assaulting women. And there was always that question of, why didn't anyone come forward? And then I was listening to an American podcast where a survivor of the sex crimes of Bill Cosby was being interviewed. And she was a black woman. And of course, Bill Cosby is a black man. And she mentioned something which I found so interesting as someone without that lived experience. She said that as a survivor who spoke out, she not only faced the usual victim blaming from people, but there was an added layer where some members of the black community around her targeted her for speaking out specifically against a successful black man. And she was told that her trauma was not as important as the fact that Bill Cosby had been a man who'd created representation for people of color in television and comedy, and that she should have valued that more than getting justice for the crimes committed against her. While Rosie was talking about the pushback from people that she got, I thought that she was probably the perfect person to weigh in on this and what her experience had been.
Absolutely. And that's always one of the targeted comments and slogans that come at me, is that, you know, Rosie's always, and these feminists are always trying to bring down a black man. Mm. But not understanding and looking into the narcissistic element of men, or and even women, and so people will call them abusers, of doing all this good. So they're putting up this front so that they have something to hide behind when they're doing all of these atrocious crimes. So we've seen it with Bill Cosby. We've seen it even to an extent, Harvey Weinstein. He created jobs. He created careers for people, but he also abused and damaged people's lives in the process. Mm. And so bringing it back home, that is always something that comes up when speaking out, particularly if it is a well-known figure. And when you look at those well-known figures, you see that they've done something within the community, used something towards their advantage. We've seen it with political figures where, I won't mention her name, but, you know, there was an affiliation between a political figure and an activist. Mm-hmm. And when this political figure came out, and well, not came out, was it came, it was, there was evidence of him beating up somebody. This person who had been affiliated with them then issued a press statement supporting him and promoting him. And, you know, the talk behind that was that, well, he had obviously done something or given something in terms of a positive aspect in her career or whatever it was that she was indebted to him. So this is just a typical and intentional narcissistic move that abusers and perpetrators do to get people in their corner. And even something closer to home for me. So we, many, many years ago, we spoke out against a well-known filmmaker. And why I attached myself to that as well was that when I spoke out, it happened many, well, the incident happened many, many years before. But what, why I was so angry at myself was that I didn't raise the flag back then. And if I had, perhaps I could have prevented so many other rapes of other people that had happened afterwards. But looking at the narcissistic approach is that narcissists have a specific tactic. So this person would come into our LinkedIn and say, you know, I've got a project I want to work on you with. Let's meet for a drink. And that for me has always been a red flag when a producer sends something in my inbox. But then it was then being in the same circle of friends where he would turn around to me and say, well, look, I'm doing this Nelson Mandela video. I'd love to get your take on it from a woman or from a producer's point of view. Mm-hmm. And then speaking to other survivors, and that's exactly the same tactic that he used with all of these other people. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, when it happened with me, and I say fortunate in a very unfortunate way, was that the first time he invited me to come watch it, we had been out with friends and had a couple of drinks, and I knew my, for some reason, I listened to my intuition. You know, they say when you drunk, your intuition isn't that clear. And I'm glad that I declined, because then the next day I was able to go look the footage. As I sat down at his hotel desk and started looking the footage, I turned around and he was lying on the bed. And I was like, oh, shit. And that's when I got up and I left. And he jumped up. And I don't know if he jumped up because he was going to attack me or if he got a fright or whatever it was. But because my instinct was there, I was able to get out, you know. And so going back to why I spoke up about it, because I was also condemned, people saying, well, you know, after what had happened to you, he only abused you verbally, because he called me all sorts of names afterwards, called me a cock tease or whatever. And I was like, but I never, ever said that I was interested in you. In fact, I always thought he was gay. And I apologized to my LGBTQI community, because for a long time, a lot of us actually did. So for me, it was also a safe space going into his room. Anyway, so people would condemn me and say, oh, you just want the publicity. And I was like, but why would I want this type of publicity? Why would I want that level of intimidation put on me? Why would I want to put myself in the firing line? Because he was the golden boy of the industry. He still is, because he still gets support and so forth in other areas. Mm-hmm. But the reality of speaking up against somebody who's claimed to done so much, and yes, who has done a lot of positivity in the industry, but has done a lot worse behind closed doors, have really destroyed lives and bodies and futures and careers through their demonic behaviors, through their sexual attacks, through their predatory behaviors. And people would rather see the good that they put up and that they've intentionally portrayed, as opposed to the damage that it's actually done to families, to people, to bodies.
And I think we see that so much in all different industries and areas of life. An individual can go as far as committing murder, but if they've also played some positive role in the world before that, there's always this element of their crime being downplayed. And the victims end up feeling like they're targets of anger and hatred. Because why did you sully this great person's reputation like this? It's a very weird human response, I think. Because both things can be true at the same time. Someone can have done amazing things for communities and individuals, and also be a predator. And when we convince ourselves that only one of those things can be true, we open up ourselves to the danger that lies behind the mask. And the truth is that very often, people with these types of predatory tendencies will set themselves up to be the good guy in the community. They will go out of their way to do good things that will create a support base for them, because they'll know that when they do get found out, their victims will be less likely to be believed. I asked Rosie if a young person approached her and told her that they had aspirations of being involved in the entertainment industry, how would she advise them to go about protecting themselves?
Definitely is that know your craft and know what you want to do, number one. So that's just a practical example. If you want to be a TV presenter, TV presenting is very different from acting, is very different from reality shows. Mm-hmm. So hone in on your craft. And, you know, with the internet, there's a lot of courses, there are a lot of spaces that you can learn from. But then also see yourself as a business. So get yourself an agent. And when you get yourself an agent, interview your agent. Your agent needs to know that they work for you. How long have they been in the industry? Do they know contracts? Is it just fly by night, or do they know this person or interacted with that person? Are they going to represent you and protect you? When I came back to acting before I was banned, and I had close to 3 decades under my belt, and I'd gotten a new agent who had been in the industry for many, many years. And so that's why I say interview as much as possible. On the show where I literally sat down with the producer and my agent, and I said, in my contract, it states that I will not take off my clothing. Why do you keep on writing this in? They lied to me and said, okay, it won't happen again. Then it happened again. It was my agent who turned around and said to me, well, you might not want to speak up, otherwise you won't get work again. And that was a big red flag for me, because your agent is supposed to stand in your honor, is supposed to protect you. Now, if I was a young person coming into the industry, I probably would have believed that and then just allowed for the abuse to happen. Point in case, there was a young girl who had agreed to do sex scenes on the same show. And I remember the scene I was called to set straight after, which was supposed to be a close set because it was a sex scene, which she had given consent to. But my disgust and shock of going on to set and finding that this young girl was walking across set in just in a G-string. Where was her manager to make sure that it was a close set? Where was her manager to make sure that she had a gown straight afterwards, that her rights were adhered to? So understand the role of your agent. When I had my talent agency, I worked for my clients. I understood that demand. I understood that mandate. And that's why I was hated in many spaces, was because I asked these difficult questions. And then also understand, and you can change your consent can be withdrawn at any point. Remember that. But also understand and know what you want to go out there. It may be great now for you to think, okay, well, I'll get the popularity that I need by showing my braces or taking off my clothing. But in 10 years' time, do you want that? If you do want to go through that, and there are great shows that particularly on Netflix, I can't think of the one show, where they've handled sex scenes in such a clean and ethical manner that even the artists that have done it explained the process and they were given the hugest amount of respect. So I'm not saying that if you don't want, if you're going on to set, you don't have to do sex scenes. But if you do want to, there are certain things that do protect you. Your rights are adhered within that space. Ask as many questions as possible. And if it doesn't seem right, listen to your intuition. Whether you're a man, whether you're non-binary, whether you're a woman, listen to your intuition, listen to your gut. If you're based in South Africa, join the South African Guild of Actors. That's the only space that I can really say that really trusts and protect actors. And I've experienced that firsthand. It just to protect you in certain circumstances like this. And then if you haven't gotten an agent yet and you see certain things that are put online, interrogate that. You know, you can find out, for instance, if it's a show in Mzansi Magic, you can find out who the production house is, contact the production house and say, are you issuing these auditions? If they're not, then you know that those posts that you're putting out there are not right, are going to lead you down astray. Just last week, somebody put onto actually on a coaching site saying that they're looking for certain personnel for a TV program. I contacted the person and they said, no, you need to send this and this and this through. And I was like, okay, but I need information on the production house. Never heard back from them. They blocked me on WhatsApp. So that automatically is a red flag that's gone out there. And also just and read your contracts. Read your contracts. Know what your rights are. Read up on what's happening and industry rights that are out there, whether it's in South Africa or whether it's not in South Africa. And then also just know that whatever space you move into, enjoy it. You know, if you have the talent, you have the right to be there. Don't let anybody try and overpower you and say, well, you don't have enough social media presence. You'll never be a good enough actress. Of course you will be. But also just know what your talent is and believe in that talent and work through that.
Rosie mentioned the South African Actors Guild there again. And I had a look at their website and I can see how they are actively working to help keep actors safe. They have an article on their website that's also a really good example of exactly the type of exploitative and dangerous situations we're talking about here. The Guild was called in 2024 to assist in what was essentially a human trafficking situation. Hundreds of people had been lured to Johannesburg from other provinces with promises of work as extras on a popular television show. They were made a lot of promises, including that if they paid their own transport money to the location, they would make that money back several times over, and that their accommodation and food would be taken care of. What they found when they arrived was something very different. The victims were presented with a tent camp as their accommodation. The tents were really rudimentary. Honestly, just your normal two-man camping tent with mattresses on the floor. There was also no formal ablution facilities. And to top it all off, they were now told that they actually had to pay 50 rand a night to sleep in the tents. When the South African Actors Guild representatives arrived at the camp, most of the individuals were too scared to speak up, saying that they'd been threatened with their lives. One elderly woman said that she'd been recruited by someone who said they were an agent in Durban, where she lived, and upon arriving at the camp, she found the situation very different from what had been presented. She'd been promised that everything would be taken care of while she stayed there, and she now found that she had to not only pay for the meagre accommodation, but also find her own food. Many of the individuals had used the last of their money to travel to what they thought was going to be a lucrative job opportunity, and most had worked no more than one day in the month that they'd been there. It seemed that whomever had arranged for these people to go there had simply wanted to have a large pool of easily available people they could call upon if and when they needed extras, and there wasn't enough work for everyone. In the meantime, they were making money off these people through the accommodation fee and taking a portion of whatever they made on set if they were able to work. The Guild partnered with A21, a global human trafficking advocacy organization, to start work to dismantle the structures that had brought the individuals there in the first place and help victims who wanted to get home to do so. Throughout her time in the entertainment industry, Rosie has also found how NDAs, or non-disclosure agreements, have been weaponized. I asked her to expand on her experiences around that.
So another thing which unscrupulous agents and production houses are doing now is that if sexual harassment happens on set, they will then call in the person who's raised the alarm and make them sign an NDA. If you sign that, you have no rights on laying charges, on doing anything in terms of protecting yourself or anybody else on set. So you have a right to say no to an NDA. Also, what we've seen with other sexual abuse cases is that, particularly with high-profile people, you'll be invited to a party and then expected to sign an NDA, and then the most atrocious things happen to you. And then you feel that after that, you have no right to speak up about it or open up a case because you've signed this NDA. Still, if you are in that situation, interrogate that NDA, because what we found over the years is some of those NDAs are not even valid. What people have done is that they've gone to a UK law site, downloaded an NDA, and the wording in there are not applicable to South African law. So more than likely, those NDAs don't stand. But if it was a case where you were drugged or where you could not give consent, that NDA falls away anyway. So don't be feared. If you have, as a younger student, signed one, don't fear that you can't gain justice or push forward because of a so-called NDA. And then more importantly, if an NDA is put in front of you, interrogate it. Ask why they are asking you to sign an NDA. If it's asking you to keep your silence, then do you really want to pursue that? Do you really want to be working with spaces like that? Do you want to be with an agent who's forcing you to sign an NDA just to keep you quiet?
In South Africa, NDAs, if they, as Rosie mentioned, are even legally binding in the first place in terms of how they're structured, are enforceable, but only if they are reasonable in scope and duration and do not violate public policy. And within that public policy part lies criminal offences, such as rape and other sex crimes, as well as anything that can be classed as a criminal offence by South African law. So regardless of whether someone has had you sign an NDA, if you've experienced any sort of treatment that is illegal, you can report it, and the NDA cannot legally stop you from doing so. As Rosie says, interrogate why someone may want you to sign an NDA. Does there seem to be a valid reason? NDAs are usually used to protect intellectual property. So for instance, I sign NDAs when I work on projects that are still in the production phase, which bars me from speaking publicly about the project until it's released. This is so that no one else can steal the intellectual property of the company I'm working with. Those NDAs specifically cover what I can't share. And if, for instance, I'm not paid for work or something else happens to me while working on that project that could be classed as criminal, I can still take action. In the entertainment industry, famous people may want to protect their personal information. I fully get that. So if you're signing up to work closely with someone relatively famous, they may want you to sign an NDA related to keeping any personal information you find out about them secret. And for the most part, this is totally fair. But that should never extend to you having to keep secrets about crimes they have committed or crimes committed against you. When it comes to unfair labor practices, that does get a bit more cloudy. But for the most part, you are still protected by South African law. I'm going to link an article in the show notes from Weber Wenzel Attorneys about NDA enforcement. It can be really difficult when you're presented with what seems like an incredible opportunity, to not just push your doubts aside and leap into something you might regret later. I've been presented with multiple instances of just that over the last 6 years, where people have wanted to partner with me, and it seemed like an incredible opportunity. But I've always had to go back to, does this align with my values and the reason I started the podcast? That's always had to be my touch point. And it's helped me time and again to make what I feel are the right decisions for the future of the podcast and the victims it seeks to assist. And I think that it's the same in any industry, even entertainment. You need to be really clear from day one what you stand for, and that will help you avoid getting trapped by the bright lights. As the saying goes, all that glitters is not gold.
And also, you know, we live in an era where sex sells. And yes, sex does sell, but also you define what you're willing to sell. So going back to that time when I was on that set, one of the directors said to a young actress, and it was a setting that was in an office. It wasn't even a sexy or bedroom setting, said, "Do you mind doing this thing? And then we'll take off your top because we need to get the ratings higher." And I said, "No, well, why don't you just write better scripts then? Why do we have to get ratings higher because at the cost of another actress?" You know, so if you're in that space and somebody is saying, "Well, if you do this, your ratings will be higher," if it's going to be at the cost of your integrity later on, you have the right to weigh that up, you know, and decide. And often people say to me, "Well, I should have just, you know, bit the bullet and couldn't have compromised on some of the things that they were putting me in or some of the scenes that they wanted to." And I was like, "But why should I? I was brought in because of my acting ability. I was brought in to raise the stakes," which the ratings did go higher. And that was because they brought in a stellar cast, not because we took off our clothing. And that's why even the show was canceled, was because some of the stellar cast were then no longer there. And even though they had brought sex scenes in, that wasn't carrying the weight that they wanted, that the channel wanted to carry. You know, so stick by your integrity, and you will get people who will question that. You will get people who will gaslight that. People who will say, you know, "You think you're all that." Actually, you are, because it's your body. Body autonomy is all about you. It's about what you don't want and what you want, whether it's somebody touching, seeing, whatever it is. You have the right to set those standards and those boundaries for yourself.
I am so incredibly grateful for Rosie's time and her insights. Those coming into the entertainment industry and those already in it are really lucky to have this tough and principled woman to stand up for them. Her knowledge and wisdom has been hard won, and she's experienced things that no one should ever have had to. But now she uses that to help prevent future victims. And I just have so much respect for that and for her. Rosie is, of course, on all the social media platforms. You can also follow her blog on Patreon, which is free to subscribe to. And she works as a life coach and certified counselor through her coaching entity, Letsatsi Healing Space. I'll link all of this in the show notes. If you've experienced any of the rights violations we've discussed in this episode, know someone who's at risk, or simply want to get more information, there are additional resources you can access, which Rosie has recommended in her blog. These include the AE21 campaign, which is international and supports prevention, protection, and aftercare for victims of human trafficking, the National Freedom Network, which is in South Africa, which builds networks against trafficking, UNODC's Blue Heart campaign, which raises global awareness and promotes reporting. And for immediate support, you can contact Lifeline South Africa, which is a 24/7 helpline on 0861 322 322. I think that all of the topics we've discussed today are relevant to everyone, regardless of whether you're in the entertainment industry or not. If you aren't in it, you're a consumer of it. And turning a blind eye to the deep issues entrenched in this industry only helps to keep predators preying and targeting the vulnerable. If you know anyone working in or interested in getting into the entertainment industry, whether it's on the social media side, in comedy, dance, acting, modeling, singing, or anything remotely related, please share this episode with them to help them move through their careers with knowledge and power. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.